read, read books, books. Read, read books, books. Read, read books, books. Hold them in your hand, and you'll hippity hoppity clippity cloppity off to a different land.
Oh, thank God the booksellers are here. We're saved. If you're looking for gift ideas, if you're looking for things to read, if you're just looking for curious about what's new and what's out and what's out there and things that you can add to your collection, well, two incredible booksellers here with us to tell us what has come on their radar over the last several days, weeks, and months. Let me introduce them to you now. Jackie Callahan is from the Golden Notebook in Woodstock, New York. Good morning, Jackie. How are you?
I'm great, Joe. How are you?
I am fine, and I thank you very much for being here. Amy Zimmerman is from Chatham Bookstore in Chatham, New York. Hello, Amy. How are you?
Hi, I am great. I'm just so happy to be here.
Always a pleasure to have you both here, and I so appreciate the time you've taken out. I know it's a busy time of year, so I so appreciate it. Let us begin with you, Jackie, and start off and begin our selections for the week.
All right. So one of my favorite fictions of the year is a book called The Silver Book by Olivia Lang. And this story begins in September 1974 in Venice, and Nicholas Wade is a young Englishman who leaves London for Italy after kind of experiencing a personal crisis. And he meets Danilo Donati, who is a real-life, by the way, so this book is kind of like historical fiction, a real-life Oscar-winning Italian costume and production designer. And so he meets Danilo Donati, and Donati brings Nicholas back to Rome and into the mythical film world of, and I'm going to try and pronounce this correctly, it's the Hollywood on the Tiber.
Oh,
it's,
okay.
It's where Fellini and everyone is hanging out. And so Danilo, who becomes the lover of Nicholas, is working on Casanova, and it's a very surreal production where the city of Venice is recreated entirely on a soundstage, right? Amazing.
And
Nicholas is an apprentice, kind of an art apprentice. And then the book shifts with Danilo and Nicholas from Casanova to the set of Pasolini's movie called Salo, or The 120 Days of Sodom. And Pasolini, by the way, is also real life, very famous Italian filmmaker. And this book is amazing because it is sort of, it's not a traditional plot arc. It's episodic. It's evocative. It's about queer love, desire. It's about artifice and truth. And what's so cool about it to me is just like kind of Italian cinema's response to a very difficult time in Italy's history. You know, you have this sort of very surreal, these two surreal, incredible movies that are both commentaries on what's happening right now. And you kind of get a glimpse into sort of like artistic creation and the costs of that. Fantastic book for people who love historical fiction. Please.
The Silver Book by Olivia Wang. All right, Amy.
That sounds really amazing. So as I'm sure many listeners know, Madeline Sophie Wickham, better known by her pen name, Sophie Kinsella, author of the Shopaholic novels, died last week from brain cancer.
Very sad.
Yeah, gone far too soon. What you might not know is that her final book, What Does It Feel Like, is a lightly fictionalized account of her life post-diagnosis. She writes about having brain surgery, learning to walk again, and trying to reclaim her memory. All told in short, punchy vignettes, it's surprisingly upbeat, or maybe not so surprising, given Kinsella's consistently bubbly and optimistic work. She makes fun of her penchant for happy endings and even tries to give herself one against all the apparent odds. And we recommend this last book as a fitting tribute to Sophie. But if you'd rather remember Kinsella at the height of her chiclet powers, I'm also going to recommend Christmas Shopaholic, which is, of course, an entry in her beloved Shopaholic series. If you haven't read the Shopaholic books, there are many of them, all starring Becky Bloomwood, a British financial journalist with an ironic lack of personal fiscal responsibility. Becky is effervescent, lovable, and witty, and her love of both the finer things and anything that she can get on sale consistently gets her into trouble, leading to all sorts of capers, larks, and all those other fun British-isms. Naturally, this series perfectly lends itself to the ultimate consumer holiday, Christmas. Christmas Shopaholic features its fair share of online shopping montages and breathless descriptions of high street holiday windows, but it also showcases a more mature side of Becky Bloomwood. I don't read many Christmas-centric books, and I'm not a Hallmark watcher, but I imagine that this book checks a lot of those boxes. There's coziness, holiday miracles, and tons of good food and camaraderie. But thanks to Kinsella's witty and self-aware style, there's also just enough tartness to cut through the saccharin, resulting in a perfect little confection of a novel. There's a moment in this book where Becky's devoutly anti-consumerist sister decides to gift all of their relatives with personalized words instead of tangible objects. Full of Christmas cheer, Becky decides that I never want anything for Christmas again except a word. Words rock, words rule, words are the best present ever. And that stuck with me, of course, as we celebrate the profound gift of the words that Sophie Kinsella left behind.
It is, what does it feel like, is the memoir. And Christmas Shopaholic is the holiday book by Sophie Kinsella. And both are out now. And, of course, all of her work available. And you can dig in. Jackie.
All right. The next book I want to talk about is The Incredible Things in Nature Merely Grow by Yuyun Lee. And this is a memoir, or even a femoir. I heard that word this week for the first time.
Really?
I'll write that down.
Do we like that?
I don't know. I was like, this was the first time I heard that.
All right.
I was like,
jury out, maybe.
Femoir.
Okay.
This is not a memoir in the conventional sense, right? There's no arc of recovery, no tidy meaning-making, no uplift. And I think that's why it's so super extraordinary. In Things in Nature Merely Grow, Yuyun Lee, she's writing with, like, super clarity about grief, mental illness, motherhood, and the survival after the suicide of her son. And I might just add the suicide of her second son. She had a previous son who committed suicide. The thing that sets this book apart is her refusal to perform grief in ways that make other people comfortable. She doesn't offer lessons, she doesn't ask for understanding, and she does not translate pain into hope. And I think that the title tells you everything about her philosophy here. In nature, things don't heal or improve. They grow, they persist, or they end. And she applies that lens to human suffering. And this is a book about continuing to live when meaning has collapsed, when language feels inadequate, and when love coexists with loss. Like, her writing is unbelievable. It is exacting. It's like surgical. It's restrained. Mm. It's unsentimental. It's precise to the point of austerity or poetry, in a way, to me. But the emotional impact is enormous. Like, you could read a sentence, and just like you can close the book and you could like really think about it. She writes about grief as not something that progresses in stages, but something that's static, it's recursive, and it's consuming. And she interrogates psychiatry, suicidal prevention narratives, Western expectations of resilience, and the moral pressure that's placed on bereaved parents, especially mothers, in her case, to move forward. It's very, very philosophical. She's in conversation, I would say, especially with literature in this book, and always quoting favorite poets and Shakespeare. She writes, I mean, she's someone who has really spent her life thinking and interrogating herself rigorously, and she refuses to stop doing that even when it's incredibly painful. So I really can't say enough about this incredible book. And honestly, you know, this is a book for fans of Joan Didion. It's sort of that level of writing. Maggie Nelson is another good comparison. It's for readers who believe in books that don't, you know, like, they don't need to be comforting in order to be truthful.
All right. And the name again is
Things in Nature Merely Grow.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Amy.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think my next book is in conversation. It's very different, but it's also a philosophical memoir, I would say, that's really meant to be savored. Mm-hmm. It's called Feast on Your Life, Kitchen Meditations for Every Day by Tamar Adler. Adler is a local author. She actually just had an amazing book launch for this with our indie bookstore friends, Spotty Dog in Hudson. And while you might know Adler from cookbooks like The Everlasting Meal or from popping up at the Hudson Farmers Market to give neighbors practical advice on their produce, this is more of a food memoir told in really lovely and accessible little bites as Adler challenges herself to eat, cook, or experience something delightful every day. Adler begins recording these slices of her days in January, a dark season like this one, so it's really relatable and restorative to read along with her as she thaws and rediscovers small joys in the kitchen and beyond, from a Tuscan dish prepared over centuries, cooked and enjoyed in the ancient town where it was perfected, to a pineapple from ShopRite, an alien, unexpected joy in upstate winter. As I said, this is not a traditional cookbook, but it's full of delightful and creative prompts for both cooking and, more broadly, for rediscovering or manufacturing pleasure. I was particularly inspired by one little trick that Adler shares. On a January day, when she is totally exhausted and burnt out and can't imagine cooking anything, she turns to her last resort and imagines a hungry stranger turning up at her door on broken skis. Suddenly, Adler knows exactly what that cold, hungry old woman would crave. Toasted baguette, butter, extra thick, thinly layered country ham, a spoonful of salsa verde, piquant with caper, anchovy, and parsley. Mm. She writes, I laughed at how readily I knew what she wanted and how simple it was to make a sandwich worthy of her. Mm. And I laughed because I got to eat it. I've been following Adler's advice and keeping this book in my kitchen, reading a bit at a time as I wait and stir, or more importantly, when I feel like I never want to cook anything again. This is a fantastic gift for locals, for cooks, and for anyone who could stand to find a bit more beauty in the everyday, which I think is everyone. Mm.
Beautiful. Tamar Adler's book is Feast on Your Life. All right, Jackie.
All right. The next book is called The True, True Story of Raja the Gullible and His Mother, and it's by Rabi Al-Medin. And this book won the 2025 National Book Award for Fiction. It also won the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. And so this book, right, if you've ever loved a novel that feels like someone is leaning in close and saying, let me tell you a story. No, wait. Let me tell you the truth about the story. This is the book. Rabia Maladin is a Lebanese writer of many books, probably the most the one known most well before this is called The Unnecessary Woman. Anyway, so it gives us, this novel is playful, it's funny, it's devastating, it's political, and it's framed as the life story of Raja, a Lebanese man who, as the title warns us, is profoundly gullible. But the real gravity of the book comes from Raja's mother, a woman whose love, sacrifices, and silences shape everything that follows. And, you know, what's cool is that this is a novel about storytelling itself. Who gets to tell the story? Who's believed, how truth mutates when it passes through power, patriarchy, war, and migration. And Al-Medin uses humor and exaggeration to explore the very real histories of Lebanese displacement, queerness, colonial interference, and survival. And it's like the comedy is disarming, and sort of the emotional weight kind of like sneaks up on you. And I think what makes this book so special is how it's sort of like multi-toned. You know, you can be laughing, then you're like, it's really sad, especially around motherhood and the way that women carry families and nations, you know, on their backs, often without recognition. And Raja may be the gullible one, but the novel asks whether gullibility is a flaw or a kind of openness in a brutal world, you know? So highly recommend this book
to everyone. Great stuff. Yes, and just getting amazing reviews.
Yeah.
The name of the book is The True, True Story of Raja the Gullible. All right. Amy.
Yeah, so since Ragtime, the musical, is having a bit of a moment right now with its Lincoln Center revival,
yep,
we're recommending that readers revisit the original Ragtime by E.L. Doctorow, which was published 50 years ago in 1975.
Is that true? 50 years ago?
I hope it's true.
Damn,
that's
I'm
what
old.
Google told me, but it might have been the
Lord.
Google AI, so we
I
should
don't
fact
like
check.
That. Okay, well, good. All right, congratulations. Golden anniversary. All right, go on.
So at the time, as you might remember, it was controversial for its mix of fictional people.
Yeah, I do remember. That's the problem.
I'll just keep rubbing it in. For its mix of actual fictional people and actual historical figures, John Updike accused Doctorow of taking gross liberties by placing real people in invented situations, even going so far as to say it smacked of playing with helpless dead puppets. Oh. The book is set in the early 1900s and features a complicated cast of characters, including a black piano player, a white family living in New Rochelle, and a Jewish immigrant and his daughter. These people collide with each other and also intersect with Harry Houdini, J.P. Morgan, and my favorite anarchist and yours, Emma Goldman. What is striking about this book now is how turbulent the political environment was at the time. There was the assassination of President McKinley, violent labor strikes, overtly racist behavior, and looming over everything, of course, the specter of World War I. Sometimes we think of the past as idyllic as opposed to our current reality, and this book is a necessary reminder of just how untrue that is.
It's also a reminder of what an amazing and gifted author E.L. Mm-hmm. Doctorow was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just some of his finest work in Ragtime, as mm-hmm. as well as many other classics. That's terrific. All right, next up.
All right, talking about some sisters who have been in the news lately, but 20th century, early 20th century sisters, which is the Mitford sisters. They're having, I feel, a cultural moment again, maybe for a couple reasons. There is a TV series called Outrageous, but there are two incredible new biographies. And that's what I want to talk about today. One of them is a graphic biography called Do Admit, The Mitford Sisters and Me by Mimi Pond. The other one is a book called Troublemaker, The Fierce, Unruly Life of Jessica Mitford by Carla Kaplan. And just to, this weekend I went to a fantastic event at another Hudson Valley bookstore called Split Rock Books down in Cold Spring, and they had an event with both authors, and it was just amazing. And so if for those who do not know, the Mitford sisters, there were six of them. They're English. They're raised in the Cotswolds by a kind of a peerage-landed gentry, father and mother. And their names were Nancy, Pam, Diana, Unity, Jessica, and Deborah. And as sort of the day, they were raised without education, with governesses that gave them just a minimal of education. They some of them begged to be educated. And strangely, they were all incredibly brilliant, and they all had a great time making fun of their father mercilessly. And sometimes I wonder if, because they grew outside of structures that reinforced kind of misogyny at the time, that as they came of age, they were they believed they could do anything. Was it their privilege? Perhaps, but maybe it was because they were sheltered from these structures, and they had incredibly wild lives that maybe some of you know about. Both Diana and Unity were known as fascists. Unity especially basically stalked Adolf Hitler and was, kind of with him for very close for a couple years, at least until England and Germany entered war. Diana as well, extremely close. But Jessica escaped the family in a very notorious and famous way. And she ended up coming to America. And in the book by Carla, she really leans, it's really the first full biography of Jessica Mitford. And I think that what she does is, rather than sort of like centering things like her wit or like the moral counterweight to the fascist sisters or just the wildness of her life, Carla Kaplan, is really interested in preserving her, like, not as a mascot, but like in an adult, unsentimental, and structurally feminist way. You know, Kaplan centers on Jessica's contradictions. You know, she's brave and sometimes wrong. She's generous and emotionally withholding. You know, it talks about how the grief and loss that she experienced in her life are not peripheral. They're central. It talks about how Jessica Mitford's toughness and irreverence were not just ideological, they were survival strategies. And by the way, Jessica Mitford was a deeply involved in the civil rights movement, and she was also a muckraking journalist in the mid-20th century and did a whole expose book about the funeral industry. And I think that so both are very, very important books. To the graphic biography, it's gorgeous. It captures things like all best graphic novels and picture books do. It's just ineluble things that add to the story in ways that you can't imagine. By the way, I'm wearing 3 pins.
Yes, you are.
3 sisters.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah. So anyway, please check out both of these books.
Troublemaker, The Fierce Unruly Life of Jessica Mitford by Carla Kaplan, and Do Admit, The Mitford Sisters and Me by Mimi Pond. All right. Amy, we've got about a minute and a half. Go ahead.
Okay. I've been challenging myself to recommend at least one romance every time I'm lucky to be here. My goal is to convince Joe to pick up one of these books. I don't know if today is going to be that day or if Daddy Issues by Kate Goldbeck is going to be that book, but I'm going to keep trying.
All right. Go on.
Thank you. This is a really great contemporary romance, so no ripped bodices, no dragons, just two complicated people with messy lives trying to make it work. Our protagonist is a 26-year-old graduate named Sam. After her post-grad plans were derailed by the pandemic, Sam has to move in with her mother in Ohio, and since that setback, she has found herself stuck, physically, professionally, but also mentally and emotionally. And Goldbeck does a fantastic job with this character. She's a really enjoyable narrator to follow. She's cool and funny, but the reader can tell how much she's struggling to move forward. Sam's involuntary adolescence is disrupted by Nick, the single dad who moves in next door to her mother. Nick is unlike anyone Sam's ever dated. He knows what he's doing and what he wants. I love these characters. They're not idealized or photoshopped, but they're entirely lovable all the same. Since I'm probably running out of time, I will add that the sex scenes in this book are really, really strong. Sex scenes are famously difficult to write. I'm just racing through this, you guys.
If you're looking for just that perfect sex scene for someone on your list.
If you're looking for the perfect sex scene, you guys, that takes place in a Chili's parking lot.
Oh, man.
Then you should pick up this book, wow. Daddy Issues, wow. By Kate Goldbeck.
All right. Daddy Issues, a novel. Kate Goldbeck is the author. We are out of time. Anything you want to make mention of before we go?
We have wonderful signed copies of Elliot Landy's new double volume book of pictures on the band. Come by, shop with us during Christmas.
That's terrific. Amy, anything you want to mention?
I don't think I could possibly add to what I just said. So
well,
I would
you're
going
to keep
say...
me from going to Chili's for a while. I know that. I urge you all to take a look at our website. All the full lists are there. And I thank you both for being here. Always a pleasure. We'll be back right after this.
Thanks so much.